Welcome to CL Talk, the leading podcast for the legal profession across Canada, brought to you by Canadian Lawyer Magazine. Welcome to CL Talk. I'm Tim Wilbur, the managing editor of Canadian Lawyer Magazine. Today, I'm speaking with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia, Deborah Smith. Prior to her judicial career, she practiced civil and family law for 17 years at McInnes Cooper. Chief Justice Smith sat in the family division of the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia until 2004, when she was appointed Associate Chief Justice and transferred to the court's general division. She was the first female Associate Chief Justice appointed in the province of Nova Scotia. Smith was appointed to her current position in 2019. Welcome, Chief Justice Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Wilbur.
First off, if you could tell me what you think some of the greatest challenges are facing the courts today.
Well, on a global level, I think one of the greatest challenges facing the courts is what I call the erosion of the rule of law. This fundamental principle of a free and democratic society seems to be called into question by some, and I have to tell you that I find it very concerning. On a smaller level, it's the condition of the courts themselves. I think that everyone would agree that a strong and vibrant democracy requires a strong and vibrant court system. The reality, however, is that many of our courts are struggling. We have courthouses that are in poor repair, and staffing levels at a number of our courthouses are at critical levels in some areas. Of course, the government only has so much money to go around, and society has many needs, such as healthcare and education. But I think it's fundamental for governments to recognize the importance to maintain and provide a strong court system.
Great. And more specifically, I know the pandemic had a huge effect on courts, both in the short term, but seem to have had lasting effects as well. So what changes have you seen in your courts as a result of the pandemic?
Well, to be honest with you, Mr. Wilbur, I think the pandemic fundamentally changed how we do business. Many of these changes are positive. For example, it opened our eyes to the benefits and advantages of technology. I think that every court in the country appreciates the need for us to modernize. And the pandemic has taught us that as an institution that's steeped in tradition, we can indeed function effectively with the proper use of technology. But there's also been some negatives. There's a whole group of young lawyers who began their profession during the pandemic, and they have little to no actual courtroom experience. They don't understand courtroom decorum or the importance of the traditions that we maintain. In Nova Scotia, at least, a number of lawyers seem to be choosing to work from home. And as a result, I think there's less team building and less mentoring going on, which in my view is a fundamental need in the life of a new lawyer. So it's going to be interesting to see how matters progress in the years to come and what the long-term effects of the pandemic are going to be.
Great. And I'll ask you a few more questions in a bit about court decorum and how lawyers work now, but more about virtual proceedings. I wanted your views on that, because I know a lot of, all proceedings were virtual for a bit, and now there's various approaches across the country for courts in that regard. What are your views on which kinds of proceedings are more appropriate for in-person, and how many proceedings can be, permanently now in a virtual format?
Well, in Nova Scotia, Tim, we've published our default positions on in-person proceedings. And basically, subject always to the discretion of the trial judge, our hearings and trials are held in person. And I fully support that position. I can tell you that people's demeanor and participation varies greatly, depending on whether they're participating in a proceeding in person or virtually. In my view, respect for the institution itself is diminished when people are calling it in. I've said a number of times that respect for the courts is never enhanced if a party is participating in a proceeding and ordering a double-double at the same time. And yes, that has actually occurred. There's always going to be a need for virtual proceedings. They're useful in many circumstances. However, in my view, they should not be the default position. I often say to people, it's not what we can do. We know that we can do things virtually. It's what we should do. And if you want to maintain respect for the institution, I think that our default position should be in-person proceedings.
Great. And I know there are arguments, you know, about virtual proceedings being, you know, opening up more access to justice. And there are, you know, some lawyers who are really pushing for this, and some who, as you mentioned, feel that the in-person is really important. I'd imagine there are some parts of the process that really are clearly suited to virtual court scheduling, that kind of thing. So are there certain areas where you just are 100% in agreement that's the best place to engage in that way?
Well, certainly when it comes to basic procedural matters, setting down a matter, doing what we call data assignment conferences, basic things that have to be done. There's no sense in requiring everybody to come into a courthouse to do it. It is an access to justice issue. It's also an access to justice issue in remote and rural areas where it's very difficult, particularly in the winter, for people to get to court. So I'm very careful to say it's hearings and trials that I feel the default position is so important. Myself, personally, I try to do motions for directions over the telephone. We don't even have to do a Teams meeting, data assignment conferences. I'll often do decisions virtually, depending on the circumstances, the parties, how sophisticated the parties are, that type of thing. But if I've got an interlocutory decision that I'm giving, I'm not going to require everybody to come in and watch me do it. On the other hand, if I'm giving a final decision and it's important to the parties, I think it's important that they actually attend court and hear the decision be given. I really feel trials and hearings have to be done in person, subject always to the discretion of the court. I mean, there are some circumstances, maybe somebody's health just doesn't allow them to come in, or in compromise, and coming into a courtroom is going to be very difficult for them. Or you've got a party who's on the other side of the country and the hearing's going to be a half a day. Well, to have them travel to Halifax doesn't make much sense. But we've made it clear that our judges always have the discretion to change the default position, but default will be in person for hearings and trials.
Great, thank you. And you mentioned courtroom decorum. You know, I didn't know lawyers ordering double-double while they were in a proceeding doesn't sound great to me. Why is this important, this issue so important to you?
Okay, just let me clarify, it wasn't the lawyers ordering.
Oh, it was
the litigants who were...
The litigants, right, okay.
They're going through the bathroom as they're participating in a family court proceeding.
Right.
But decorum is really important. The judges on my court are very aware of my position on this. I feel that public respect for institutions is diminishing generally. And in the vast majority of cases that we deal with, at the conclusion of the case, we just issue a piece of paper. And we want individuals to abide by that piece of paper. If we want them to do that, they have to respect the institution itself. And in my view, the only way that they're going to respect the institution itself is if we insist on having proper decorum.
And how does, you mentioned this a bit already, but how does technology fit in with this? How do you address the role of technology in your court with related to courtroom decorum?
Well, technology has really presented some challenges for us in relation to courtroom decorum. Whether it's lawyers who are improperly attired when participating virtually, or witnesses that don't seem to appreciate that they're still in a courtroom when they're participating virtually, I find that there's a real difference in decorum when conducting a virtual proceeding. And I think it's incumbent upon the presiding justices to ensure that the parties and counsel all understand the importance of maintaining decorum despite the fact that we're using technology. So we in Nova Scotia have developed guidelines relating to virtual proceedings, which are designed to help maintain decorum. But I will tell you, we struggle still. Even if you send out those guidelines to the clients and to the lawyers, it's understandable in some cases. They're in their living room, you know, their dog comes in or whatever, things happen in life. It's just a whole different feel when it's done virtually. So I'm not suggesting we not use it. I think there's a real use for technology in the future of the court, and we embrace it in many ways. But if we want to have respect for the institution, I think we have to ensure that we don't go purely virtual and have what I call telephone court. I don't want telephone court in the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia.
Great. So I wanted to ask a bit about your work in judicial independence as well. You're the chair of the Canadian Judicial Council Judicial Independence Committee. Can you share some insights about the work that you've done there and the importance of judicial independence for you?
Sure. Well, this committee is actually very multifaceted. obviously, as our name implies, we're concerned with protecting judicial independence in Canada. In my view, a strong, independent judiciary is crucial to having a robust democracy. We work to ensure that the public and government representatives have a proper understanding of what judicial independence is and why it's so important. In addition, in the past few years, our committee was tasked with revamping the ethical principles for judges. And it really just made sense that the Judicial Independence Committee be in charge of that project. The CJC felt it was important that judges have up-to-date ethical guidelines in place, but it was also important that the judiciary's independence be respected in the drafting of that document, and our committee understood the need for both. And finally, the part of our mandate is to provide input into the judicial application process, what works when it comes to the application process, what improvements can be made, and that type of thing.
Great. And you mentioned the ethical principles for judges. What changes were made to modernize those in the work you did?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm extremely proud of the work that the CJC did in preparing updated ethical principles for judges. We're all aware of the issues that are seen across the world these days in relation to the judiciary and ethics. And we were in a very timely spot when we decided to revamp the principles. They provide judges with advice on many areas that we face on a regular basis, but they also provide the public with a good idea of the type of conduct that's expected of a judge. And in my view, our principles really do help instill confidence in the judiciary. We tackled a number of new topics when updating the principles, including the use of social media, how to properly assist self-represented litigants, which was something we rarely saw when I started out as a judge, but we had regularly in our courtrooms. We talk about the use of case management and settlement conferences. I have to tell you that over the years, I've realized that when people file in a proceeding in the Supreme Court, they're not necessarily looking for a trial. They're looking for a resolution of their dispute. And if we can provide a resolution that's less expensive and less emotionally taxing, I think we serve the public better and enhance access to justice. So we thought it was important to include principles about doing settlement conferences, mediations, and the like. We also dealt with topics such as public engagement. I think judges are much more public. The very fact that I'm doing this interview with you is evidence of that. Believe me, I don't think 10 years ago I would have done that. We discuss the need for ongoing professional development. We have a wonderful education program in Canada for the federal judiciary. We're proud of it, but we recognize that all of us require ongoing education in many different areas, substantive law, but also social context education, and the new principles cover that. And finally, one of the new topics we dealt with is the really interesting topic of post-retirement return to practice. Because 20 years ago, when you became a judge, that was your final career. And that was what, when you left this job, you left for good and you retired. Now, many people leave this job and go do other jobs. They go back to the practice of law. They choose to do something else. So we thought it would be useful to put some ethical parameters around the post-judicial return to practice.
Great. Well, there's a lot there. I could keep asking questions, but I want on that, but I want to be brief. So as I mentioned in my introduction, you were the first woman appointed as the Associate Chief Justice in Nova Scotia, and you were also the second woman appointed as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So what advice would you give for other women who want to pursue a leadership role in the legal profession?
Well, first of all, I think I'd say hang in there. Historically, a number of women have chosen to leave the practice of law early, and there are real opportunities for women out there, but you can't take advantage of those opportunities if you don't remain in the profession. So I would really encourage them to stick it out and continue on their career path. A second, it's important that you believe in yourself. I find that women can have a greater tendency to question their own abilities, but they shouldn't do that. Their abilities will speak for themselves. And finally, I say, stay true to what you believe. Historically, the law was a man's profession. And last evening, I was watching a great documentary on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I was struck by the fact that they said there was only a handful. I think they said 9 women in a class of over 900 law students. So all the others were male. And that was at Harvard Law School. It's a concept that's even hard to imagine today, quite frankly. But women bring their own perspective and they have life experience that they have to bring to the table. And I would encourage them to not feel that they have to mold themselves into a man's world. Bring the perspective that you bring to the table, and you are who you are. I hope, quite frankly, we get to the day where it isn't newsworthy that it's a woman who's got a position like this. I think we're almost there. I hope we're almost there. But don't give away who you are as an individual. Bring your own perspective and be proud of it.
Great. And speaking of bringing a perspective, I believe you've been in the legal profession for over 40 years now. So what changes have you observed in the profession over that time?
The change in the practice of law over the last four decades is quite frankly shocking. People find this hard to believe, but when I started in the practice of law, there was no such thing as a billable hour. Young lawyers won't even understand that concept, but you took your file at the end of the day, you looked at it, you saw the result you accomplished, and you decided what a reasonable invoice would be. We didn't even know what 0.6 meant. That has changed totally now. I can remember one of my greatest joys when I got appointed to the bench was that I didn't have to record my time all of the time. In many ways, I'm sad to say this, but in many ways, I think that the practice of law has gone from being a profession to a business. And in some ways, this might have been necessary, but I encourage every lawyer to remember how fortunate we are to work in the law and how important it is to remember that we're still a profession. When I was a young lawyer 40 years ago, it was expected that you would follow a senior lawyer for a number of years and learn the ropes. But much of that seems to have disappeared. It's very surprising to me how many young lawyers come to court. They have nobody mentoring them, and they really don't know what they're doing, understandably, because law schools don't view it as their job to teach people how to actually be a lawyer. And if you don't have a mentor, you're struggling when you come into the court and they're looking at me to try to teach them. It's very hard to do that, but appear to be unbiased to the other side. So I think it's important that senior lawyers take time to mentor and help train new lawyers, and that junior members of the bar seek out mentors to help them navigate the challenging first few years.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for speaking with me today and providing all these insights about what's happening at your court and your career and your views on how the profession's changed. We look forward to hearing more about the developments at your court, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Wilbur. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to CL Talk. You can listen to the latest episodes on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, and all major listening channels. Just search for CL Talk.